our family to your family. This is A Legacy of Faith, the podcast.
Welcome to A Legacy of Faith, a podcast designed to help your family survive the day, plan for tomorrow, and always keep an eye on eternity. We're glad that you've joined us for the 85th episode of the program, and as has been the case the last several episodes, I'm joined again by Leah. Leah, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Leah, we are recording this the night before it comes out, and we are tired.
Yes.
Because we've had quite a week.
Had vacation Bible school.
Yeah, it's vacation Bible school for us is good. The kids love it, but you and I co-teach, which really means you teach and I like hand you stuff or, you know, throw hailstones at the kids, which I actually did, but they weren't really hailstones.
No, styrofoam.
Yeah, no lawsuits, please. The story we taught, the Bible account we taught, was the day the sun stood still, and so we have enjoyed that. We have Sunday through Wednesday vacation Bible school, but recording this on Thursday night to come out on Friday, and you know, I was thinking as I was kind of getting ready for the podcast tonight that in a lot of ways, with that being out of the way, summer's just about done. Well, the major events of summer really are done.
For us, yes. I mean, there'll be school in maybe 2 weeks, two or three.
I was wondering. I had that typed out. I put back to school with like five question marks behind it.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly when. It just depends.
That's one of the beautiful things about homeschooling. It's like we might start Monday or Tuesday or next week.
Well, we have something coming up that will kind of determine, I think, when we do that. So that's
one of those projects.
One of the projects. One of the projects.
Just go on.
Depending on when they finish, we're going to be working in the kids' bathroom. So depends on if they can finish that or not before it's time for school and what all's going on with that.
Yeah, for those of you keeping track at home, we've finished 62 of the five projects.
We're getting close.
And I think we still have two or three to go somehow.
We're getting close.
I don't know how this math works, but
I'm going to make more grape jelly.
Yes. We made grape jelly, last weekend? And tomato juice.
Mm-hmm.
We frozen some tomatoes, and so that's coming in. The garden's slowing down, but mostly because we just, frankly, have not had time to keep up with it.
Mm-hmm.
But we've given some stuff away and probably giving some more stuff away the next few days because it's just, right now, we're busy enough that about all we can do is pick stuff. And the garden doesn't look all that great, but stuff's still coming in kind of slowly. So people driving by are probably going, I thought the garden looked pretty a couple weeks ago or so. Yeah, life happens.
Vacation Bible school happens.
That's right. That's the way it works. So all right. Anything else you want to talk about just on the life front before we get to some articles?
No.
That was easy enough. Mm-hmm. You shared an article several days ago. It actually came out on July the 4th. What?
I do think we should change the name of our podcast to Stuff Leah Shared on Facebook.
Instead of Legacy of Faith, be Leah on Facebook?
I guess.
Ooh.
Every time L-O-F. We have our podcast.
L-O-F. It still
works. You shared this on Facebook.
You did. This was by our friend Steve Higginbotham. He preaches in the Knoxville, Tennessee area, the Carnes Church of Christ. And it was an article on a subject that we've written about on the blog a couple times. I have. I know. I think Jeremiah has, maybe some others. But the name of the article by Steve is Children and Technology in Church. And like we usually do, Leah, why just generally did this kind of strike you as something you wanted to share? Then we'll get into a couple specific things from it.
Well, I've said this. We've talked a lot about technology and children just in general on our podcast the last few weeks. It's always catches my eye because it's just so prevalent now. You know, it's just such a part of life for the kids that's something we've had to confront, like what we're going to do as parents. And so it's interesting to read about things like that, just to have an idea of what people think, and that's why really that,
you know,
I saved it.
One thing, Steve starts the article, and I appreciate him saying it because I know Steve, you know, fairly well. You do as well. This is not being written by somebody who hates technology.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's probably not a tech geek, but obviously he has a blog, but Steve, you know, keeps up with stuff. He has some newer things. So this is by a guy who enjoys technology, but he's basically saying there's some excuses that sometimes people give when they let their kids, you know, play on an iPad during church or just mess around their phone or whatever, especially smaller children. One of me talks about it. Sometimes people will give the excuse that, well, worship services are just for grown-ups. Now, there's a sense in which that might be true. You know, grown-ups meaning, you know, a Christian, you know, someone who's old enough to be a Christian. There's a sense in which that's true. But what?
I was just saying that what he was saying about the worship services are just for grown-ups. He's saying that that's what you teach children,
mm-hmm.
not what people use as an excuse, but when you let them do that, you're showing them
right.
that. So I just want to clarify.
Yeah, that becomes the excuse. It's just for us. It's just for right. adults, you know. And so the kids can just kind of be on their own and everything. Again, there's a sense in which that's true, but kids are going to grow into faith only when we allow them to be a part of worship service and learn those wonderful songs and hear sermons and learn how to pray and everything. And there also is a sense in which children are a part of the worship service because, you know, that old milk of the word thing comes to mind where, yeah, they may not understand every word of the sermon, especially when it's talking about a difficult subject or a deeper text, but something's going to be said or a song is going to be sung or something's going to be said in a prayer that virtually the smallest children can understand.
I remember teaching a while ago at Polishing the Pulpit a lesson about training young children in worship. And I don't know, I don't fucking remember exactly, but I remember breaking it into three different levels. And in the first level was just maybe the first year of a child's life that really you were just, and I can't remember, oh, I had, you know, the good wording, you know, that teachers will use to kind of make every point kind of the same, but you know, the point of that was you were just trying to make sure that child was quiet in church so other people can worship. But then right. the second one, you know, the ages maybe from, you know, 2 up until 7 or 8 years old,
yeah, very,
even
very early elementary.
Right. That's when you're teaching them. I don't know if I can make this be exactly how I said it, but I think that was the age where I tried to present it like that's when you're teaching them to worship,
right?
Because you know they're not in an age, I mean, they would be able to sing praises. They'll be able to hear things about God, that, especially if you're teaching them at home, that they will recognize, but that you're going to teach them to worship. But then as they got older, and it was about the ages our kids were then, is that then in my mind, I was trying to teach them how to worship, like be involved in the worship more and mm-hmm. more. And so I think there's a difference in that. So to me, that point, you know, that when you are letting them just sit and not be and be unengaged in the entire service, that you're not teaching them to worship. They may not be able to fully take part in it, but when you sit there and you make them be quiet and you make them not get up like 3-4 times to go to the restroom, you know, when you're trying to teach them that this is important, what we are doing here is important, then even if they can't fully understand everything in the sermon, even if they don't know all the words to the song, but you're still showing them how to act during worship. And when you do that, you're really teaching them to worship, and that will stay with them their entire life. You yeah. know, that this is what we come to do, and this is why we're here. So this is not, well, we're going to do this, so you just sit back and just be, you know, be quiet and don't bother anything. So
the other thing he says that we teach children when we don't, or when we give them tablets, phones, whatever, is that God doesn't really have any expectations for children. You know, that God expects adults to worship, or God expects adults to sit quietly, or God expects adults to whatever, be reverent, but he has no expectations for children. Now, he points out Psalm 148, somebody can read that, you know, that beautiful psalm and everything. But the key to that text is that everything in creation praises God. We sing it. Hallelujah, praise Jehovah is what, you know, that turned into that hymn. But, you know, God has expectations for everybody. Now, his expectations are different. You know, a 4-year-old sitting there in church, I don't think God expects them to sit perfectly still and know all the meaning behind, you know, O sacred head now wounded or anything. But I think God does expect a child, like you said, to be learning how to worship, be setting in those foundational stones, you know, in their life. And so, you know, when we talk about worship, and I see it everywhere I speak, pretty much. You know, and I'm not saying that as somebody who speaks, you know, every week somewhere different, but local work, but also go speak somewhere, you know, in a gospel meeting or a summer series. And I can honestly say I see it everywhere I speak where there are kids in the audience. I see kids on phones or tablets, literally everywhere. And I'm not saying that because that's what I'm looking for, but it's hard to miss it when you look out, and you can't do this on an audio podcast, but all the heads are facing down, you know, everybody who's 5 years old and under. And I have been so tempted, Leah, so tempted so many times during a sermon to just stop and say, all right, everybody report the scores of your games. I have been so tempted to do that. You know, I may do it one of these days, but just go ahead and have you haul on speed dial.
Well, and some people might say that, you know, something like that, especially with small children, would not be any different than taking a bag full of books for them to look at. And I don't know, I guess there's a point to that argument. But, you know, if you are really diligent, and I mean, we can't say we always were. I remember taking lots of books for our kids, and maybe even a coloring book and a few little crayons when they were really small.
Well, I'm not trying to just justify us or anything, but you usually, I mean, I would say 90%+ of the time, the books or things had something to do with the Bible.
Well,
they were Bible story books or creation coloring books or something.
That's what I was going to say. We did gradually move in that way. So, like, definitely we are not saying that we always had it right or anything, because there were times where I remember, you know, maybe hearing another young mom talk about, you know, in their church bag it was Bible books. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, you know, to myself, like,
yeah, have we looked through the bag lately?
Maybe I need to think about that. But that was what she was trying to do. This is the different time that we have. I'll tell you when I was really convicted about kids in worship is that sermon that Dan Jenkins preached.
You've mentioned on the podcast
when
before.
We were at Lebanon Road for a, you know,
it was a gospel meeting
1 year. And our kids were still so little, but it was just hearing him preach about coming together in the sacredness of worshiping, and you know, he took you to scripture from even in the Old Testament about what we do here is not, and it's so needed in our culture. And I want to get a copy of that just so I can listen to it.
Yeah, Mary Carroll couldn't have been older than probably what, 5 or 6?
Probably, yeah.
And turned them
we had just started homeschooling. Yes,
so, yeah, 4, 5, 6, somewhere right in there.
Or no, that's wrong. She was in the second grade.
Okay, so about 6 or 7, maybe. But like you said, the key phrase that I remember you taking away, as you mentioned on the podcast for us, is the sacredness of it, the sacredness of worship. And children, look, do they understand all about worship? No. But there's a sense in which we are teaching them when we bring them to worship, when we take worship seriously, when, you know, maybe they have their own little Bible or a Bible storybook or something, that this is different. Something different is going on here.
That different.
And it may not be they understand sacredness yet, but there's something very special about this, because I'm not bringing in the iPad and playing Minecraft, or I'm not pulling out, you know, Daddy's phone and playing Angry Birds or whatever. There's something different going on here. And kids, very, very young kids can... So I appreciate Steve's article so much, you know, about that, and encouraging parents, you know, not to avoid technology everywhere, but to realize that when you hand kids a tablet, a phone during worship, and just let them whatever play games, you know, that sort of thing, you're not teaching them special, and you're teaching very, very opposite lessons. All right, article number 2 is one that I know, because I'm actually going to talk for once, Leah, about an article that I wrote.
Oh,
I wrote this week, an article about immodesty, and I've learned the secret to blogging, Leah. Write about modesty. Usually when I write an article, you know, Jeremiah, you, whoever writes an article, you know, I'm not going to give the numbers. We kind of know X number of 100 people are going to read it. You know, we obviously have the people who get it through email. It's, as we're recording this, I'm actually looking right now, 1,748 people get the emails. Another 100-ish get through RSS. And we usually can know, okay, this number of people is also going to, you know, click through on Facebook or Twitter or whatever. But anytime, and I mean anytime, one of us writes about modesty, it's at least tripled, and sometimes it's 8, 9, 10 times normal.
I wonder if it's in a good way or bad, or you think it's good that people...
I think most of it's good, because I think the people that I see shared on Facebook, and I'm not one of those that sits there on Facebook all day and see how many people, you know, go through the list of who shared it or whatever, but when I see it, it's usually with a comment of like, we need this, or please read this, or parents take this to heart, or this is excellent, or what. And I'm not saying it to brag, I'm saying because there are people out there who are starving for other people willing to say, this is an issue.
Because you never hear people talk about it, even from the pulpit.
Well, the article, I entitled it, He Looked Down. It was from a story. I didn't give the guy's name, and it was a preaching friend of mine. It's Jeff Archie is the one who tells the story about a little boy who was over at somebody's house, and every once in a while he would look down, and they couldn't figure out what he was doing, and they finally asked him, and he pointed at the television and said something like, that girl's not dressed enough, and Mama told me never to look at a girl to embarrass her.
Uh-oh.
And it just... you know, woke the family up. But the point of the article, as I wrote it, was that sometimes we don't link these things, but modesty and respect go hand in hand. And every time we choose to be immodest, and we're talking about this on a family podcast, you know, helping our kids understand this, and we as parents understanding it and that sort of thing, but every time we choose to be, you know, underdressed, you know, scantily clad, if I use the older phrase, some level of respect just dies, and it's respect for all kinds of things. You know, you said we don't hear it, you know, and it's true. You go anywhere virtually in our culture, and the norm is going to be normal to immodest, not normal to overly modest, I guess the best way to put that. It's going to swerve towards, you know, the immodest. And for the podcast purpose, what I want to think about for a couple minutes here, Leah, is when we do that sort of thing, when we dress immodestly or, you know, whatever, we're teaching our kids that's how you get attention, that's what matters, that's normal. And that's not good, because that's not what we need to teach our kids. We need to teach them that, you know, God gave you your body, not just your soul, that God gave you, you know, your body to cover, to be saved from marriage, all those sorts of things, but also it's not how you get attention just to show more skin. And it also, all right, here we go. This is our podcast. Somebody's going to start a different podcast just to go against this one. It also doesn't really matter where you are. I can, you know, some people will be modest at home, modest at church, but wear the cheerleading skirts on Friday nights that show more than any person should see. And they're a Christian, but because they're at the cheer, you're wearing a cheerleading outfit, or because they're at the beach or whatever, everything's okay. And it's not okay.
I would say, you know, the older I get, the more I've wondered.
You're not old.
Well, getting older. But I've thought so many times about, you know, this, the attitude of modesty, even when you're talking about, even in private settings, you know, that there is just a level of... discernment and discreetness.
Discreetness. That's the word I thought you were going to go for.
Yeah, well, that's probably the one I was trying to go for first. But discreetness that someone should have, even if they are just among family or among all other girls, you know. And I've really been trying to think of that, is where is there a line even with that? And I think it's, you know, it's hard to always pinpoint that line.
Yeah.
But it is, the attitude is what is just so... missing sometimes, you know.
And you're not talking here as somebody who, you know, wears a formal dress to vacuum the living room.
I just mean like, you know, is there just the attitude of being modest in your actions and in your dress, even when you are among, you know, what we might, you know, like if I guess, you know, thinking about camp, you know, mm-hmm. and you know, camp is camp, and everybody understands that. But, you know, even if there is a line of when do you as a person need to learn, and that's the word, you know, discreetness, even if you're in your cabin and it's all girls, you know, just that attitude of modesty and respect for yourselves. I don't know if this is making sense.
I know what you mean.
Just to be able to, you know, have that attitude that you know your body is precious and mm-hmm. you are special, and just to, you know how, not just in how you dress but even in how you're acting,
right.
You know, that's important for us to be teaching our children, that, you know, just how to be a modest person all the way around.
Yeah, that's a good point. One of the things I just mentioned in passing in the article, and I'm going to let you speak to this a little more because you obviously buy the kids' clothes, you know, 10,000 times more than I do. Well, that makes it sound like we have 10,000 clothes, but you buy them a lot more than I do. And you've talked on the podcast before. You've done a lesson at Polish the Book before. I'm buying modest clothes for young girls. But instead of just talking about the clothes in general, one of the things I mentioned in passing in the article is the messaging on the clothes, even for younger girls. Yeah, I am just shocked sometimes. You know, walk by whatever it's called, the juniors department or the, you know, little girls department at virtually any store, and it's not pictures of, you know, a little pony, or it's not pictures of, you know, whatever. It's, parents, I'm sorry if this bothers you on the podcast, but it's, I'm sexy, or I'm a hot thing, or whatever. Mm-hmm. You're seven. That has nothing to do with it. And that's scary that we buy it for little girls and we kind of giggle it away.
Well, I mean, I was just buying Mary Carol some new jeans or denim capris, I think. And as I was looking through, it was in the junior section at a store. And, you know, the stickers on the jeans were talking about enhancing a certain part of your body. And that's what the clothes you look through, I mean, they're just, it's a sticker on the pants.
Mm-hmm.
And as if that's what we should be trying to teach our girls, that's what you need to be trying to do.
Yeah.
To enhance that particular part of your body.
Number one, we're not talking about, you know, being unhealthy, but, you know, girls shouldn't be worried, you know, body typing, body shaming. That's number one. But then also teaching them that if you felt like you needed to, the way you do it is to buy it. You know, mm-hmm. you don't exercise or diet or mm-hmm. those sorts of things or just take care of yourself. You go buy a piece of clothing. Well, guess what that's going to lead to eventually? You buy any clothing just to make yourself look like the girl in the magazine or the girl on the billboard or the girl on the TV show. That's a dangerous road mm-hmm. for a girl to realize, oh, I can just buy my way into looking however I want to look. That's kind of scary too. Right.
But it's just that what we're, you know, as a society, what we're teaching, especially girls, and I know, you know, oh, boys, but especially girls, just to a greater percentage, you know, it is, their marketing strategies to girls in general is how to look and have the best body.
Mm-hmm.
No matter what it is, whether it's, you know, swimsuits or, you know, jeans, you know, everything has to be like, well, I'm going to say the word, you know, everything for young girls now has to be sexy.
Yeah.
It has, you know, and you see it all the time everywhere. And it's just a scary road when you're raising a girl, you know, Mary Carol's 11. It's a scary time because, I don't, you know, you want to teach them how to be beautiful and, you know, how to take care of themselves.
In a modest way.
You know, and you know, you want to teach them to take care of their bodies, to be healthy and to eat right without that turning into, you know, eat right so you don't gain weight, so, you know, you don't look fat and one's going to like you.
Or eat right so you look like that
girl. Right, you know, so it's just so hard instead of just, you know, being able to feel like you can relax about everything. You know, it's just hard to be raising, especially girls now, because of that. Boys have their own challenges, but...
Can I just mention something that has nothing to do with this article, but we've mentioned the word a couple of times and it just drives me nuts. Are you sick of the word sexy in our society?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sick of
like
it.
Everything is.
This cell phone is. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. No.
Yeah, it's not.
buy this hamburger. Yeah. No, it isn't.
Yeah.
This cell phone is not. And,
yeah.
But even that, I think that speaks to a decline in society mm-hmm. when we have to use erotic terminology
absolutely.
To describe a cell phone mm-hmm. or a tablet or something. It's
that's what drives people,
yeah.
you know.
It's craziness. Yeah. But so let's get off that subject.
Yeah, we're
okay.
Yeah.
You love when I do this. I picked out one article you've never seen.
Uh-oh.
And I'm even pulling the computer away, you can't
what?
See it. Because all I'm going to do, it's from a blog we've mentioned on the podcast for Of the Hearth. It was an article she wrote several weeks ago called 5 Myths Our Culture Tells Us About Marriage. Now, instead of, you know, going through these deeply, okay, and I'm not going to give the reasons. I just want to give you, Leah, I'm going to read each myth to you and that you react to it. Because I actually agree with each of the 5, that these are myths, you know, when they are said just without any explanation. She is so happy right now. This is when I wish this was a video podcast, because, well, actually I don't, because you might be watching my murder here in a moment. Myth number one. Once you get married, you'll live happily ever after.
That's my reaction to that.
Well, what makes that a myth?
Well, because you're not. I mean, you're
That's
not.
That's going to be your answer to all these. You're just not.
I mean, life is full of exactly. frustrations and disappointments. You know, newsflash, you're going to be disappointed in your marriage at some point. And that's when most people will just take off, because they think, oh, it's not supposed to be this way. And, you know, it is. I mean, you're going to be mad at one another, and, you know, you'll be disappointed in one another. You're going to be wishing that they did better at that, or that, you know, your marriage was better at that or this. And
but on top of that,
you're not going to be happy all the time.
There is kind of the concept of happily ever after, but it doesn't just happen because you get married. It takes work.
Right.
It takes effort to get to where, not that, you know, it takes work just to make a happy day or whatever, but even a long season of happiness doesn't just happen because you got a ring on your finger.
Right. You've learned mutual respect, and you've learned how to really love one another.
But just think about how many TV shows, movies, books, what's the plot? They get married and they live
happily ever after.
Yeah. So
doesn't mean you don't love each other ever after. It just means that you're not going to be all smiles and just happy, happy, happy all the time. And
yeah, that ties to number two. Myth number two. Healthy marriages won't have conflict. That's the portrait. Is there a wonderful marriage because they've never had a disagreement in their entire life? If they've never had a disagreement in their entire life, they're the same person.
Right. Well, I don't know. You know, people talking about being... compatible.
Yeah.
A lot. And I know what people mean about that, but no two people are going to be completely compatible. I mean, really, if you think about that, you're still two different individuals. And when you get married, that's part of the marriage, is you have to come together, and what you want doesn't really get to happen anymore. And what they, the other spouse, wants doesn't really get to happen anymore. And now it becomes what you or we want, and our needs more than, and so, yeah, that breeds conflict, because you have two different individuals.
That's right.
Coming, butting heads sometimes, you know, you have something you think, I have something I think, and that's part of marriage, is having to figure out, what do we think now, and how are we going to handle this instead of how I handle this?
And one of the funny things, and I think every couple, I'd say we struggle with this, you know, to some extent, but one of the funny things about it is, when you're dating, when you're engaged, a lot of those opposites are what attract you. And then when you get married, they drive you nuts.
I read an article about that once, and it was talking about that very thing that,
let me interrupt you. Maybe I shouldn't say it's what attracts you. It intrigues you. It's probably a better way of saying that. Anyway, go ahead.
Or it was cute. That was the article or a sermon or something about, you know, marriage and about how a lot of times that happens. You know, you think it's cute that they, you know, do something this way, and that's cute, you know, just...
That they're just silly all the time.
Yeah, they're silly all the time. Or, you know, he's laughing all the time at something. Well, there's going to come a point, you know, in the marriage that you're not going to want to be laughing about something. You're going to want to be take something serious, and you've got to, you know, and that can make a person think, well, I don't like that anymore, you know, that doesn't make me happy anymore, that, you know, he or she's doing that. But then the lesson was about remembering those things about when you first met and you first, you know, began your relationship, to kind of remember, take yourself back to those things.
But there's going to be it's not that marriage is an exercise in this, but one of the exercises of marriage is there's going to be conflict. How do you work through it? How do you handle those times where you butt heads, or where you just your personalities clash for a moment or whatever? And it's not that happens every day, but it's going to happen. And sometimes on little things, sometimes on big things. And marriage sometimes is, we're going to work through that. But the picture is always, well, it's a healthy marriage, they never have conflict. No, that's a healthy marriage because they've learned how to work through conflict and how to deal with those things. All right. Myth number three, and if you're listening with your kids, give us 2 minutes. You might want to fast forward 2 minutes. Okay, just giving you the fair warning here, because we're going to talk about that subject, okay? Myth number three, Leah. Myth number three the culture tells about marriage is sex is infrequent in marriage. Now, I think that's a myth, because it could be true, but the myth is, and let's be honest, we're living in a culture where sex is everything. We talked about that a few minutes ago.
The passion dies.
The passion dies, or let's just speak of the people who aren't Christians. If you're not married, you probably have more sex than if you are. That's the picture that the culture paints. It really is. That once you get married, it's just, that part of your marriage just becomes boring, infrequent, to use her word. And I love the way I think the way she worded that myth is very fair. That the myth is sex happens infrequently in marriage. I think it's a fair way of wording that myth. You agree? You're like, I don't want to talk about this. I said to give us 2 minutes. We got another minute here.
I do agree. You were saying exactly what I would have said about it, that with TV shows and everything, even magazines, that even magazines, if it's going to be about sex and marriage, it's always about how to spice it up in marriage,
Yeah. She actually...
If you see, headlines and stuff like that.
She actually cites in here, by the way, the research is actually the exact opposite. That, now, there are exceptions, but we might say committed couples in marriage, it's actually more frequent than the average person who's not married. But anyway, I'm glad she put that on the list, because that's something that we're fed constantly in the culture. It's either infrequent or it's boring. Mm-hmm. That's what you're bringing up. Myth number four, the Beatles song, Love Is All You Need. That's a perfect one for this list. Love is all you need. Wrong.
Because that doesn't take into account what you mentioned earlier, respect for each other.
That sounds almost biblical.
Yeah. We've talked about love and respect.
Yeah. But there's several problems with that, if that's the way you feel about it. Number one is, you better define love the right way.
Right.
Is it erotic love? Well, no. Is it even just being a friend? Nope. But also, that love of just, she's just the cutest thing ever, and I can't think of anybody but her and everything, that can only carry you so far.
Well, and if I like what you said there, it depends on what kind of love you're talking about. If you're talking about the agape love, where you're going to do the best for each person involved, then maybe that. But there's also commitment, that even, because we're human and we're not going to always love each other the right way.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have that, though, and commitment, then you stay and you work things out even when one or both of you is not loving in the right way.
Yeah.
Maybe one person is being selfish, or maybe one person's being negative or whatever, or involved in something else that's taking up too much of their time, or whatever. You can throw, if you're married, things that might be a problem in marriage.
And not all of them are sinful.
The love, might still be there if you're trying to take care of each other, but it's the commitment. They're not always going to be doing things the right way, but we're going to stay even when we're not. It's the vow you take in marriage, just that, for better, for worse. Even when things are bad, even when we are tired of each other, even when we are mad at one another, that you still stay, because that's the vow you made. And that's commitment, and love. So love's really not, you can love a lot of people.
Yeah.
Really. And you can really biblically love people and want their best interest at heart and everything, but...
Well, Christians are commanded to agape love all kinds of people.
But marriage is different, Right. It's that idea of it, what we've mentioned before, is a covenant. It's an agreement you make.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that is, even when the love is not there, we'll still stay.
Yeah.
We'll be there.
Myth number five is one I've actually been seeing written about a lot lately, talked about, and I'm glad to see it. Myth number five, happy marriages happen when contributions are split 50-50. The old marriage is 50-50 thing.
Yeah.
That's a myth, because
it's not always 50-50. Really? And if you think about it.
It really should never be 50-50.
Right. I know what you're saying. You should all be giving. You should be willing to do all the compromising. Both people are working that way. Yeah, it evens out a lot. But, it doesn't always even out. There are times, it's just like what we were saying, things ebb and flow. And, you have in your mind the young couple that gets married, and maybe the guy is still in school. and he's working maybe during the day, taking classes in the evening. Maybe she's working. Well, there's going to be times in your life where you end up, you know, maybe taking the brunt of some of the not so pleasant parts of being married.
Yeah.
You know, the house, or if you throw kids in there, mm-hmm. if you're young and you have children while all this is going on, then, you know, maybe the mom is really there and she's up with the kids in the evening, you know, later and while he's studying. And but then there comes a time maybe when it's, the other way around. Maybe the dad is going through harder times at work for a long time, these years of working, and the mom maybe isn't, you know, as day-to-day working, literally working, you know,
right.
like around the clock, like he might be during those certain times of family life and everything. So it does. I mean, it's not always 50-50.
Yeah.
You can make yourselves miserable trying to make it that way.
And the goal really should be 100-100. You know, everybody gives everything they can.
Right.
It's, and that's biblical. Philippians 2, mm-hmm. I forget the verse. You know, look not only for your own interest, but also to the interest of others. That's kind of biblical, last time I checked. You know, that we look out for other people.
Well, and
so
I,
you give as much as you possibly can all the time, instead of like, okay, I've done half the work, you do half the work. Or I've loved you halfway, you love
mm-hmm.
me halfway. No, I love you all the way, you love me all the way. And
right.
as much as possible. So it's 100-100.
This is a true story that when I was a young girl, I heard a lady talking about someone she knew. Someone very, very close to her that she knew, that their marriage was, or the lady involved in the marriage really took this to heart, as in she made up her half of the bed. She did her laundry. She did her dishes.
Wow.
Yes.
Wow. I'm glad you didn't take that lesson to heart.
I mean, you know, well, that's 50-50, right? You know, I mean, if you really think about that, then yeah, that's what you do. But we all know in healthy marriages that is not what that means. It's not, you know, I'll do half and you do half.
I mean, interesting when she washed
I'll
her half
stop
the car.
At half, no matter what you do or not. That's a recipe for failure in marriage.
Yeah.
Because what you just said, you know, what if the time comes where you have to go more?
Yeah. It would be interesting when she washed her half of the car or something. That became interesting. All right, well, we've gone like 36 and a half, 37
minutes.
We're doing
this a lot more here lately.
What, going longer?
Yeah.
That's good. That's okay. We're not on radio. We don't have to worry about being done at the exact second. So anything else you'd like to add before we are done?
No, I love you. You say that to me.
Oh, thank you. I love you too. We've discussed three articles. The one from Steve Higginbotham about children and technology and worship. The one that I wrote about modesty, and then the one that did you like the list, myths of marriage?
Mm-hmm.
Did you like that?
Yeah.
See, that list. You can find links to all of those, each of those articles, on the show notes for this episode. And those show notes can be found at fawnfamily.com/POD85. 85 episodes into this thing, and people still listen. It's amazing. Fawnfamily.com/POD85. We'll be back with you again, Lord willing, in 2 weeks for the podcast again. And until then, remember, your family can go to heaven. Just make sure you go there together.